Some cities have wounds that never fully close. Houston, Texas, has more than its share of them. But there is one wound, specific, deep, and particular, that stayed open for nearly 36 years. It had a name, two names actually, Cheryl Henry and Andy Atkinson. They were 22 and 21 years old. They were young and in love and full of the kind of energy that only belongs to people who don't yet know what is waiting for them in the dark. On the night of August 22nd, 1990, they went out together in West Houston. They danced. They laughed. They were exactly where they wanted to be. And by the following morning, they were both dead. What happened to them? Out in a remote stretch of West Houston, down a quiet road that had come to be known as Lover's Lane, became one of the most haunting unsolved crimes in the city's history. For almost 36 years, nobody was charged. Nobody was named. Nobody answered for what was done to Cheryl and Andy in the dark. And then, in the spring of 2026, everything changed. This is the story of a long night, a longer silence, and the man who authorities say finally has the answer for both. My name is Maya Vale, and this is Among Monsters. August in Houston is not kind. The air is heavy and wet, and it wraps around you like something alive. The sky stays orange long past sunset. The streets stay busy long into the night. Houston in the summer of 1990. Was a city in motion. It was the kind of summer that felt permanent. Too hot to think clearly. Too loud to feel afraid. Bayou Mamas was a nightclub on West Hymir at South Gessner in West Houston. It was exactly the kind of place you went when you were young and the night felt infinite. Loud music, cold drinks, a dance floor packed with people who had not yet been given a reason to be anywhere else. On the evening of August 22nd, Cheryl Henry went there with her younger sister, Shane. They were going to meet someone, a young man Cheryl had been seeing for just a few weeks, a young man who had recently arrived in Houston from North Carolina, with green eyes, a wide smile, and the kind of easy confidence that made people warm to him immediately. His name was Garland Andrew Atkinson. Most everyone called him Andy. He was 21 years old. He hadn't been in Texas long. He had moved to the city just recently, still getting his footing, still figuring out what his life in Houston was going to look like. And then he met Cheryl. And for a few short weeks, everything must have seemed exactly right. Cheryl Henry was 22. She had blonde hair, bright energy, and a way of being in a room that people remembered long after they had stopped being able to explain why. Her sister would later describe her as someone who lit things up simply by being present. Someone who was kind without effort. Someone who was exactly who she appeared to be. That night, the three of them, Cheryl, Shane, and Andy, were together at Bayou Mama's. Dancing, laughing, spending a summer evening the way people do when they are young and alive and nothing bad has happened yet. At some point during the night, Cheryl and Andy left together. Shane watched them go. She had no reason to worry. There was no reason to worry. They were a young couple going somewhere quiet. That is all it was. That is all it was supposed to be. None of them could have known that this was the last time Shane would see her sister alive, that the last image Cheryl's family would carry of her was from the parking lot that summer night, that warm and ordinary darkness. Andy and Cheryl drove out to a stretch of road in West Houston that locals had long called Lover's Lane. It ran near Enclave Parkway, close to Eldridge Parkway, out where the city thinned into undeveloped land and the streetlights disappeared. In 1990, that part of Houston was remote, quiet in a way that places are quiet when there is nothing around them, the kind of place where people went to be alone. And on that night of August 22nd, someone else was there too, watching, waiting. Before we go any further, before we follow the investigation, before we talk about what was found at the cul-de-sac on Enclave Parkway, I want to spend some time with who they were, because the case became famous. The crime scene was infamous. The headlines ran for decades. But Cheryl Henry and Andy Atkins were not headlines. They were people. Cheryl was the kind of daughter and sister who left a mark on a room long after she left. Her family described her as bubbly and bright, the one who made you feel seen, who showed up for people, who carried others without ever asking for credit. Her sister Meredith Culvert, speaking years after the crime, remembered her with quiet precision. She described the way Cheryl had looked at Andy, how she thought he was remarkable, not just his smile, but his mind, the depth behind the easy charisma, the way he thought about things. Andy had only recently moved to Houston. He had came down from North Carolina just weeks before his death, and somehow in those few short weeks, he had already became someone Cheryl trusted, already became someone her family was beginning to know. His cousin Tim Godwin was so close to him that they thought of each other as brothers. When the news broke, Godwin said he had fully believed, completely expected, that justice would come within 3 to 6 months, that they would find whoever did this and bring them in, that the world made enough sense for that to happen quickly. He was wrong. But the belief itself says something about who Andy was. People who loved him fiercely enough to believe that losing him was an injustice the world would correct right away. Andy's mother, Ann Fowler, carried her grief softly but permanently. Years later, when asked what she most wished for, she answered simply. She said she wished he was still here, that she could picture them at the beach together, having a good time. The smallness of that image, not a grand wish, just an ordinary day with her son, is the kind of thing that stays with you long after you've heard it. These were not complicated people. They were not living dangerous lives or tempting fate. They were two young people in the early weeks of a romance, doing exactly what young people do on a warm summer night. Nothing about them invited what happened. Nothing about their choices that evening made them responsible for what came next. They drove to a quiet road. They parked. They were together. And someone found them there. Cheryl did not come home that night. By the next morning, August 23rd, her family knew something was wrong. Cheryl had recently started a new job. She was the kind of person who would never simply not show up. Her sister Shane later said that the moment she realized Cheryl hadn't called, hadn't checked in, hadn't appeared, something in her already knew. Not the facts, not the details, but something. Houston police were called. A search began. And it was a security guard doing nothing more than a routine patrol through an area near Enclave Parkway who found what they were looking for. A white car parked in a cul-de-sac. It had not moved in some time. The windows were rolled down. The security guard approached. He found an unresponsive woman inside the vehicle. He called for help immediately. When officers arrived, they found a second victim nearby, an unresponsive man. Both Cheryl Henry and Andy Atkinson had suffered injuries to their necks. Both were pronounced dead at the scene. Cheryl's purse was still in the car. Her shoes were still in the car. Her mother, Barbara Craig, rushed to the scene when word reached her. She was held back by officers, held at the perimeter, unable to reach her daughter. She would carry that moment for the rest of her life. In an interview years later, she said something that is almost impossible to hold in your mind once you have heard it. She said that if they had let her go to Cheryl, she would have breathed into her. She believed with her whole heart that her daughter would still be alive. There is no way to measure what it cost a mother to live with that. The area around the car told a grim and deliberate story. Andy had been tied to a tree, not near the car, not a few feet away, bound to a tree. The cuts on his throat were so severe that investigators described the wounds as approaching near decapitation. Cheryl had been moved from the vehicle. Her body was found hidden under wooden boards approximately 100 yards away. She had been sexually assaulted. There was a $20 bill lying near her body. And the detail that would haunt investigators most, even decades later, was this. Andy's golf balls and golf clubs had been deliberately arranged to point toward where Cheryl's body was hidden. Positioned. Purposeful. As if the killer was directing anyone who came looking. One retired HPD detective, speaking to reporters years after the crime, said she had gotten sick to her stomach thinking about what Cheryl and Andy had endured in those final hours. And there was one more detail, a brutal one. Detectives told Andy's father that based on what they found at the scene, they believed Cheryl was killed first, which meant that Andy Atkinson, bound to that tree, helpless, unable to move, had heard what was happening to the woman he cared for. He had known what was coming for him, had waited. Andy's father, Garland Atkinson Sr., put into words what most people cannot bring themselves to say. He said it was hard to accept that his son had been made to endure that, to know, to wait. Houston Police Department Homicide Division caught the case that morning, and from the very beginning, it had the character of something carefully executed. The scene was not the result of a confrontation that spiraled. It was not random violence. It was not frenzy. It was controlled. There was binding material. There was a knife. There was a sexual assault. There was deliberate positioning of objects. Whoever did this had taken their time. And whoever did this appeared to have left very little behind that could be immediately identified. In the days and weeks following the murders, investigators spread outward. The nightclub where Cheryl and Andy had spent their final evening was canvassed. People who knew the victims were interviewed. The remote stretch of land near Enclave Parkway was examined carefully and repeatedly. The challenge, the first of many, was that in 1990, forensic science was not what it is today. DNA testing existed, but it was still new and still expensive. The database that would one day connect evidence across cases and across decades were only beginning to be constructed. What investigators had was a crime scene, physical evidence, witness accounts of two people who had been seen alive at a nightclub and were found dead by morning, and a question with no immediate answer. Who had been out on that remote stretch of West Houston Road on the night of August 22nd? And why? Weeks passed, then months. The case generated leads. Over 100 persons of interest were examined across the years that followed. Multiple detectives worked at it at different points in time. A retired detective named Billy Bleak reportedly gave 2 decades of his career to this case. 2 decades chasing a killer whose face he could not yet put a name to. Nobody was ever charged. For Andy's cousin, Tim Godwin, the initial certainty that justice would come quickly gave way to something much harder. Months became a year. A year became 5. 5 became 10. 15 years passed with no arrest. Then 20. Andy's father never stopped pressing. According to people who knew the case well, Garland Atkinson Sr. called detectives regularly, insistently, consistently, never letting anyone forget his son was still waiting for an answer. Then in 2001, a letter arrived at the Houston Police Department. The writer claimed to have information about the case. They wanted $100,000 to share it. Investigators could not determine whether it was the killer taunting them from a distance or simply a stranger who had followed the story and saw an opportunity. Either way, it led nowhere. The case stayed cold. While the Henry and Atkinson family waited, while detectives worked through leads that faded and years accumulated into decades, there was a man living life in Houston, Texas. Ordinary on the surface, unremarkable in ways that most people read a stranger. The kind of person you pass on the sidewalk, stand behind at the gas station, see in the parking lot of a grocery store, and never think about it again. Floyd William Parrott. In the summer of 1990, he was 28 years old, 6 feet tall, 185 pounds, brown hair, and mustache. He was not famous. He was not wanted for anything major. He was not the kind of name that came up in conversations about crime in the city. But if you looked closely, if you traced his history through the arrest records and court documents and police reports quietly accumulating over the years, you would find a pattern, a particular and very specific pattern. In May of 1998, Floyd Parrott was arrested in Harris County for impersonating a peace officer. He was placed on probation. It was not treated as a major offense. People moved on from things like that, but Parrott didn't simply move on. In December of 1988, he was arrested again, this time for carrying a weapon, specifically a blue steel revolver. He was convicted. The revolver was eventually returned to him. In May of 1990, just 3 months before Cheryl and Andy were killed, Floyd Parrott was arrested once more for impersonating a peace officer. Again, he was out on bond for that charge on the night of August 22nd. Free to move through the city, free to drive wherever he chose, free to be exactly where he decided to be. And here's the thing about Floyd Parrott that investigators eventually piecing together his history found so striking. His work address from his 1988 arrest records placed him just over 1 mile from the cul-de-sac on Enclave Parkway, where Andy Atkinson's white car was found. Just over 1 mile. He knew that area. He had worked in that area. He was familiar with the landscape, the roads, the particular way that part of West Houston went dark and quiet once you move past the last line of development. He knew which places no one was watching. Here's the detail that changes everything, that reframes in a very specific way what Cheryl and Andy may have experienced on that road. That answers, at least in part, the questions of how a man approaches two people in a parked car at night and gains control without chaos. Floyd Parrott drove a particular kind of car. In the late 1980s, investigators say he had a vehicle outfitted in a very specific way. It had been retrofitted with red and blue lights, police lights, the kind of lights that, appearing in your rearview mirror on a dark road late at night, mean only one thing. You pull over. You roll down your window. You wait to be approached. Because you believe, because you have every reason and rational reason to believe that the person walking toward the car is a law enforcement officer. Floyd Parrott is accused of using that car, that fake authority, that manufactured trust. According to the Harris County District Attorney, Parrott had a documented history of presenting himself as law enforcement that stretched from the late 1980s all the way through the 1990s and into the 2000s. Different cars, different methods, different roads, but the same essential deception every time. the same borrowed authority, the same manufactured badge. He walked up to people who believed they were safe in his presence, who believed they were required to do what he said, who had no reason to run, no reason to question him, no reason to be afraid. Investigators have not publicly stated whether this is exactly how he approached Cheryl and Andy that August night. The precise sequence of events on that stretch of Enclave Parkway is not yet fully part of the public record, but the picture it creates is not a difficult one to hold. A young couple parked on a quiet road, headlights appearing behind them, the red and blue flash. The reasonable decision, the only decision most people would make, to stay calm and comply. If you believe you are being approached by a law enforcement officer, you do not run. You sit still. You follow instructions. You trust. That trust, manufactured, stolen, completely false, may have been the first weapon Floyd Parrott used that night. 2 months before the murders, in June of 1990, there was another crime. A woman who worked as an exotic dancer at a nightclub called Gigi's in Northwest Houston left her job at the end of her shift. A man appeared at her home. He told her that her boyfriend owed him money, and then he attacked her. He pulled her hands behind her back and bound them with duct tape. He covered her eyes and her mouth. He put a bag over her head. When investigators eventually examined the description this woman gave of her attacker, his height, his build, his brown hair, his mustache, it matched Floyd Parrott precisely. The description she provided of the weapon he carried matched the blue steel revolver that Parrott had been arrested with in December of 1988, the same revolver that had been returned to him by law enforcement. And there was one more thread connecting this assault to the murders that followed. One detail that made investigators look at everything twice. The woman who was attacked in June of 1990 had, at one point in her life, worked for Andy Atkinson's father. Whether that connection was deliberate, whether Parrott had somehow encountered both of them through the same channel, investigators at the time could not be certain. But it was a thread, in a case that needed threads badly. The 90s became the 2000s. The 2000s became 2010s. The case never closed, but it moved slowly, painfully slowly, in the way that cold cases move, not forward, not backward, not sideways, gathering information without resolution, accumulating evidence without answers. The Houston Police Department's cold case unit kept the file active. New detectives took it over as others retired. Billy Bleek, who spent 2 decades chasing this case, was one of them. He later spoke about it publicly, about the particular weight of working a case that the families needed solved and the years kept refusing to resolve. About the dead ends, the tips that dissolved, the composite sketches that generated hope and then nothing. Every year that passed without an arrest was a year those families spent grieving without any movement toward closure. And every year was another year Floyd Parrott moved freely through Houston. The city grew around the crime scene. The remote, undeveloped stretch of land near Enclave Parkway didn't stay remote forever. Buildings went up. Roads got busier. The cul-de-sac where Andy's white car had sat, windows rolled down, Cheryl's shoes still inside, became part of a developed corridor in West Houston. The geography changed. The case did not. Investigators continued to search for physical evidence, continued to re-canvas, continued to follow threads that seemed promising and then dissolved. Portraits of two 20-year-olds stared out from Crime Stoppers posters. The kind of posters that people walk past 100 times until the faces become wallpaper, until they stop being people that become symbols of something unsolved and therefore, in the cruelest way, forgotten. Cheryl's family refused to let that happen. Andy's family refused to let that happen. They kept the names alive in every way they could. They kept calling. They kept asking. They kept showing up. Then in 2008, something finally shifted. Not enough to end the case. Not enough to produce a name. But enough to confirm what had been suspected. Investigators ran the DNA that had been collected from the crime scene, specifically from the June 1990 sexual assault, through the National DNA Database. And there was a match. The DNA from the attack on the woman from Gigi's nightclub matched evidence connected to the Lover's Lane murders. The same man had committed both crimes. After 18 years, that much was now a certainty. But the match went no further than that. The unknown suspect was not in the national database under his own profile. They knew what he had done. They still did not know who he was. What the match did give them was the ability to take a new step. Investigators located the woman who had been assaulted in June of 1990. They interviewed her again, nearly 18 years after the original attack. She agreed to work with Lois Gibson, the Houston Police Department's forensic sketch artist, a woman whose composite portraits have helped solve more cases than most people can easily count. Together, the survivor and Gibson created a sketch of her attacker. It was then age progressed to show what the suspect might look like in 2008. The sketch was released to the public. Reporters covered it. The case got attention. Tips came in. And then the tips led to dead ends. Because no matter how many people looked at that composite sketch, no one stepped forward with the name investigators needed. The man in the sketch stayed nameless. Cheryl's father, Robert Henry, put into words what the whole family was living through by that point. He said somebody out there knows something. He said if they would just come forward, maybe it would ease their conscience. He said it calmly, not with rage, not with collapse, with the quiet, ground-down exhaustion of a man who had been waiting for justice since 1990 and has learned to wait without breaking. Nobody came forward. Not then. Cold case work changed significantly in the years that followed 2008. Forensic science did not stand still while the families waited. DNA analysis became more sophisticated, more sensitive, capable of extracting information from smaller and older samples, capable of doing things that would have been considered impossible in 1990. And there was a newer investigative technique, one that had only recently became viable for law enforcement, called familial DNA analysis. The concept is precise but powerful. If a suspect's DNA profile is not in the national database, investigators can sometimes identify close relatives whose DNA is in a database, a sibling, a parent, a child. And from those partial biological matches, they can begin to trace a family tree. Working outward from branches, they can see toward a root they cannot. Houston investigators began exploring this approach for the Lover's Lane case. It was not a fast process. It was not guaranteed. It required patience on a timeline that is almost impossible to explain to a family that has already been waiting 30 years. It required investigators to work the science alongside the grief of people who had been told, by every year of silence, that the answer might never come. That the man who took Cheryl and Andy might simply never be found. The idea that an arrest could still be made 30, 32, 35 years later required a particular kind of faith. Faith in the science. Faith in the investigators. Faith that the world is a long enough timeline, a place where things eventually come to light. That is a hard thing to hold on to for 3.5 decades. The families held onto it anyway. Meanwhile, the families continued to wait. More years passed. Cheryl's sister, Shane Craig, speaking in a documentary produced in 2025, talked about the case with the clarity of someone who had been living inside unresolved grief for decades. She remembered the night at Bayou Mama's. She remembered what the windows of Andy's car looked like when investigators found it. rolled down, blood on the door, cigarette butts inside, evidence that Andy and Cheryl had been there, sitting together, spending time together, doing what people do on a warm summer night before everything ends. Shane said she had known something was wrong before she had any facts to confirm it. She said she had spent years waiting for an arrest. And she said, quietly and plainly, that she had eventually stopped believing one would ever come. Not because she doubted the work law enforcement was doing, but because 35 years had passed. Because she had come to believe that the man who killed her sister might already be dead. That he might have taken the secret to his grave. And that Cheryl would never have an answer. She was wrong. In late 2025, someone reached out to investigators. They had information. They had a name. Floyd William Parrott. We do not know who made that call. We do not know what their relationship to Parrott was, or what finally moved them to pick up the phone after all these years. Court records state that only a tip was received, naming Parrott as a person connected to the 1990 murders. Investigators began to work. They pulled Floyd Parrott's criminal history, and what they found was a document of a man who had been living in the margins of law enforcement's attention for years. The impersonation arrest from 1988 and again in 1990, the weapons charge, the 1996 sexual assault case, which had been no-billed by a grand jury at that time, the probation records, the court filings, the work address from 1988 that had placed him just over a mile from the crime scene at Enclave Parkway. His physical description, 6 feet tall, 185 pounds, brown hair, mustache, matched the description given by the June 1990 assault survivor precisely. The blue steel revolver she had described matched a weapon Parrott had been arrested carrying in December of 1988. The same weapon that had been returned to him by law enforcement. Each piece of information was manageable on its own. Circumstantial, possible. But together, they began to form a shape. A particular and unmistakable shape. Investigators ran a new DNA analysis, this time with Floyd Parrott as their specific target. When they compared his DNA profile against the biological evidence collected from the 1990 crime scene, evidence that had sat in an evidence locker for 3.5 decades, there was a match. The same DNA that had waited unidentified in a national database for nearly 20 years. It was him. What makes the case against Floyd Parrott so striking is not the DNA alone. It is the architecture of life spent operating in the shadow of legitimate authority. Court documents filed in connection with the capital murder charge reveal how investigators reconstructed his presence across time and geography. His first impersonation arrest, May of 1988, placed his work address just over a mile from the cul-de-sac where Andy Atkinson's white car was found. An area described in investigative documents as undeveloped and remote in the early 1990s. His second impersonation arrest, May of 1990, had him out on bond throughout the summer of that year. The summer the assault happened. The summer Cheryl and Andy were killed. Records confirmed he was not in custody during the June assault. Not in custody during the August murders. He was free. He was in Houston. He was in that part of Houston. The physical description from the assault survivor aligned perfectly with how Floyd Parrott looked in 1990. The weapon she described aligned with the weapon he possessed. When investigators more recently ran his work address from the 1988 through a mapping application, they found it sat just over a mile from the cul-de-sac at Enclave Parkway. He knew that land. He had worked near it. He understood its geography in the dark. And then there was a fake police car. Photographs that the Harris County District Attorney's Office released publicly showed an older model vehicle retrofitted with law enforcement style lights. A car designed to make people stop, to make people comply, to make people believe they were safe. The DA said he had information that Floyd Parrott had used vehicles like this, had impersonated law enforcement in this way from the late 1980s through the 2000s in different vehicles, in different ways, consistently. The tip from late 2025, the renewed DNA analysis, the criminal history, the physical evidence, the geographic proximity, the timeline, all of it was presented to the Harris County District Attorney's Office. The charges were accepted. Capital murder. By the time investigators arrived at his door, Floyd William Parrott was living in Lincoln, Nebraska. He had left the Houston area sometime in the years before his arrest. When exactly and under what circumstances is not fully known publicly, but he was found. On the night of March 25th, 2026, an FBI SWAT team and Houston Police Department Homicide Division detectives moved on his location in Lincoln. Floyd William Parrott, now 64 years old, was taken into custody. When investigators interviewed him that same night, he denied knowing Cheryl Henry. He said he had no knowledge of what happened on Enclave Parkway in August of 1990. He denied it. 36 years of two families waiting. And when the man they finally charged said the words, he said them to investigators holding DNA evidence that said otherwise. The following day, March 26, 2026, charges were formally filed in the 176th Criminal District Court in Harris County, Texas. Capital murder. Parrott appeared in a Nebraska courtroom to contest his extradition. The Harris County District Attorney's Office moved to obtain a governor's warrant to compel his return to Texas. District Attorney Sean Terre said he expected Parrott back in Harris County within 45 days. And at a press conference the morning after the charges were filed, Terre addressed the families directly. He said the unsolved murders had weighed incredibly heavily on the Henry and Atkinson families and on the wider Houston community for more than three decades. He said that stopped now. He called the case one of the most haunting and infamous in the city's history. He stood in front of cameras and said directly that his office would pursue the full picture, not just the two murders already charged, the full picture of what Floyd William Parrott had allegedly been doing in the Houston community across decades, and who else might still be living quietly with what he had done to them. It was not a press conference that tied things neatly together. It was one that opened more doors than it closed, that acknowledged plainly that 36 years is a long time for a person to move through a city unseen, and that the account of what happened on Enclave Parkway in August of 1990 may be only one part of the story that eventually gets told in full. He said his prosecutors and investigators had worked hundreds of leads, faced dead ends, and plenty of frustration, and had never given up on Cheryl and Andy. He thanked every investigator who had ever touched the case. And he said what two families had been waiting 36 years to hear. The progress had come. The hope was real. That the wait was over. When the news broke, two families who had spent 36 years in a particular kind of grief found out and responded in their own particular ways. Andy's stepsister, Francisca Del Rosario, said she fell to the floor when she heard. She couldn't believe it. She said the day had finally come. She spoke about Andy's stepfather, a man who had called detectives every single day, who had hounded them, who had never given anyone the comfort of forgetting that Andy Atkinson was still waiting. Andy had moved to Houston from North Carolina just weeks before his death. In those short weeks, he had found a place, found people, found someone to care about. And then he was gone at 21 years old, before his life in that city had barely begun. His mother, Ann Fowler, had spent decades carrying the simplest possible wish that they were at the beach together, having a good time, something ordinary, something that should have been easy to have. For Cheryl's family, the news arrived at a press conference where Shane Craig, Cheryl's younger sister, the one who had been there that night at Bayou Mama's, who had watched them leave and never saw her sister again, stood in a room and wiped away tears. She said her sister was more than a victim, more than a headline. She was a daughter, a friend, a person who brought love and light into the lives of everyone around her. She was taken, Shane said, in a way that no one should have to experience. And she said one more thing, something that has the weight of 36 years behind every word. She said her sister was not a cold case file. She was not a data point in a database. She was not a composite sketch on a Crime Stoppers poster. She was Cheryl. And she deserved to be remembered as Cheryl. Cheryl's family released a written statement. They called Cheryl and Andy truly incredible people, kind, loving, with so much life ahead of them. They said they had never imagined this day would come. They said they had never given up hope. They thanked God that the suspect was finally in custody. They thanked law enforcement, and they thanked the people who had stood beside them through every year and every dead end and every moment when the silence stretched so long it seemed permanent. Cheryl's father, Robert Henry, had asked years earlier for whoever knew something to come forward to ease their conscience. Eventually, through DNA and decades and a single tip in late 2025, someone did. There is more. When the charges were announced, District Attorney Sean Tear did not stand at a podium and declare that the case fully resolved. He did something different. He asked the public a question. He released photographs of Floyd William Parrott from around the time of the murders. He released photographs of the retrofied vehicle with the police lights, the fake patrol car, the instrument of false authority. And he said he believed that there were more victims, not just of Lover's Lane murders, more victims of Floyd William Parrott, victims of a man who had operated across years and decades and different roads in the greater Houston area, in different cars and different guises, but always with the same manufactured authority, the same false badge. He said they needed the full picture. He said that if anyone recognized the man in those photographs, if anyone had been pulled over, stopped, or approached by someone using those lights on a dark road, he needed to know. He said there are people right now still living with what Parrott allegedly did to them, living with it alone, quietly. The way victims of a man this careful often do, without anyone ever confirming that what happened to them was real, that it was not their fault, that someone is finally paying attention. Investigators noted that across all the years of the case, across more than 100 persons of interest examined, across decades of detective work, Floyd Parrott had never been directly interviewed. He had never been brought in and questioned about Cheryl and Andy. He had moved through Houston for years after the murders. He had lived quietly. He had eventually left the city. And for a very long time, nobody said his name out loud in connection with the cul-de-sac on Enclave Parkway, until one day someone did. There is something specific about the way this case refuses to stay contained. It keeps expanding. A double murder in 1990 becomes a cold case that haunts a city for decades. The cold case generates a DNA match in 2008 that reveals a connected assault. The assault leads investigators to a survivor who helps build a composite sketch of a man nobody can yet name. That nameless sketch hangs in the air for 17 more years. And then one day, someone picks up a phone and says a name. And the name turns out to fit. Floyd William Parrott, 64 years old, arrested in a city far from Houston, charged with capital murder for what is alleged to have happened on a quiet road in West Texas on a summer night 36 years ago. There is no way to give back what was taken, not to Cheryl Henry's family, not to Andy Atkinson's family, not to the woman from Gigi's nightclub who was attacked 2 months before the murders, not to whatever other names are still waiting to be connected. But there is a charge filed in a court of law. There is a man in custody. There is a case that, after 36 years, is finally moving towards something that resembles reckoning. Cheryl Henry was 22 years old. She was a daughter, a sister, a friend. She brought love and light to the people around her. She went to a nightclub on a summer night and never came home. Andy Atkinson was 21. He had just arrived in a new city with green eyes and a wide smile and a whole life still ahead of him. He had been in Houston for just a few weeks. He had just found someone worth caring about. They deserved to go home that night. They deserved everything that was supposed to come after. And the people who loved them deserved answers a very long time ago. If you have any information about Floyd William Parrott or believe you may have encountered him in any capacity, you are asked to contact the Houston Police Department Homicide Division, Crime Stoppers, or the Harrison County District Attorney's Cold Case Division. I'm Maya Vale. Among Monsters is produced under Fuzzy Life Entertainment. If this story reached you, please leave a review, share the show, and come back. There are more stories waiting. There always are.